Hello, and welcome to the Paragon Care FY23 results announcement. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one one on your telephone. You will then hear an automated message advising that your hand has been raised. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce Group CEO and Managing Director, Mark Hooper.
Thanks, and morning, everyone. Welcome to the full year results presentation for Paragon Care. I've also got Josie DeMartino with me today, our Group CFO. Let's get into it. For Paragon, the last 12 months has been really focused on getting clarity around our longer-term strategy and putting in place the building blocks to execute against our longer-term ambition, targeted at 100 million dollars of EBITDA by FY27. One of the challenges is making sure at the same time we continue to make progress in terms of organic growth in the short term, and as you'll see in today's presentation, we've delivered on both fronts. That doesn't mean all the work's done, but we now have a much clearer path towards our end goal. As I've commented to a number of people, I'm more confident of the organic growth we have in front of us now than when I spoke to you 12 months ago. So let's start with a few comments on the results themselves, remembering that we pre-released the headline numbers a few weeks ago. Josie will go through this in a bit more detail in a few moments. Sales are up 29%. This is probably a little bit lower than we were expecting. This is partly due to the fact that we've removed the Lovell sales result from these numbers, and there was a little bit of softness in some parts of the business, but still a strong result. Underlying EBITDA was up by 35% to 38.4 million, and while this mainly reflects the inclusion of Quantum and SMS, on a like-for-like basis, there was organic growth across the business of approximately 10% during the year. The stronger EBITDA growth then flows through to an underlying NPAT increase of 61%. ROIC's down a little on the first half on what we reported, and I should probably just note here that we've restated the return on invested capital calculations for the inclusion of the amortized intangibles on the Quantum merger, which wasn't included when we did it last year. So that's why the numbers look slightly lower, but it's round about the same mark that we had in the first half. The board's also declared a fully franked dividend of 0.006 a share, which is consistent with last year in the first half. It's about a 43% payout ratio overall, and on a fully franked basis, represents a yield of about 7.5%. We've also reintroduced the DRP, which is a great opportunity for shareholders to take additional equity and also helps manage the direct cash impact from paying the dividend. Last but not least, our year-end debt figure on a pre-AASB basis has increased by around 14 million, which mainly reflects the SMS purchase completed in the first half. Critically, all of the outcomes we've targeted for FY23 have been delivered, and I've talked to the market about this before. You know, we put this slide up the front of the presentation for the past couple of results we've done, just to say, "Well, this is what we told you we were gonna do. This is what we've done." We originally talked to the market about underlying EBITDA growth for the year of around 30%. It's ultimately come in at 35%. This, as I mentioned earlier, this includes like-for-like organic growth of around 10%. When we presented at the half year, we also said net debt would fall to about 65 million by year-end, which is done. It's come in at actually slightly lower than that. The mergers and acquisitions we took on in the form of Quantum and SMS have both been integrated successfully and are performing strongly. As people who followed Paragon for a while would know, integrating businesses has sometimes had its challenges, so it's really pleasing to see how these particular mergers and acquisitions have played out over the last 12 months. You know, they've been integrated successfully, and they're growing. It also gives us a great platform to support other areas of the group, particularly in the service area, and also as a platform for a further push into Asia. All of the initial work on our strategy has now been finalized and reviewed and approved by the board, and as a direct result, and you'll see this in more detail later in the presentation, there's now a number of initiatives actively underway that will provide additional earnings uplift over the next few years. So with that brief introduction, I'll hand you over to Josie to take you through the results in more detail.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, everybody. I'll indulge a little in the financials over the next few minutes. I'll start with the profit and loss statement. Really pleased to announce our strong result here. We had a reported net profit after tax of 13.6 million, but our underlying net profit after tax came in at 15.6 million, which is 61% higher than the previous corresponding period. Mark's already spoken about revenue, and which was up 29%. We've had our gross profit margin came in at 41.1% versus last year at 41.7%, and that's a really strong result, largely unchanged, despite the fact that we did have higher capital sales. Operating expenses, they've come in at 91.8 million. They have grown, but a lot less than sales, which is all reasonable. That then takes us to the underlying EBITDA of 38.4, which is 35% up on last year. The key driver of our underlying EBITDA is the inclusion of SMS. So we do have 10 months of SMS contribution in our results and the full year there for Quantum, including organic growth, as Mark touched on, for the remainder of the business. Therefore, we've got an underlying EBITDA revenue of 12.5% compared to the prior year of 11.9%. Our basic earnings per share came in at 1.64 versus 1.41 last year. Again, an increase of 16%, which is healthy. And Mark's already spoken to our underlying return on invested capital of 8.5%, compared to the prior year adjusted number of 8.7%. I'll now take some moments to just step through the results from a pillar lens, commencing with diagnostic and scientific. So revenue, and this revenue excludes other revenue. So sales revenue of 38.3 million, with an underlying EBITDA of 6.5 million and a ROIC of 12%. The decline in ROIC there from the first half is due to the dual rents being paid for Parkville and Mount Waverley site. The diagnostics has had a successful year. Mark's already spoken about the success with regard to the transition of SMS into the pillar, and that provided us with strong sales and also strong cross-selling opportunities. We had a positive year elsewhere. However, there was some slight underperformance in pathology consumables and lower VTM sales, which were COVID-related. Stepping through to devices. Devices had a strong year, especially in ending in quarter four. They had revenue of 78.7 million, an underlying EBITDA of 12.2 million, and a ROIC of 14%. Sales were strong. Elective surgery continues to recover past COVID, with orthopedic volumes up approximately 30% compared to the prior comparative period, and strong sales performance in ophthalmics, particularly in quarter four. Now, this result for devices was really positive, despite there were significant headwinds from the prosthesis list reimbursement reductions, elective surgery caseload uncertainty arising from hospital staff shortages, and international supply chain issues. Looking now at capital consumables, revenue of 95 million, underlying EBITDA of 12.8 million, and ROIC of 13%. Capital consumables pillar delivered a consistent performance in FY 2023. This was despite a slower than expected recovery of surgical procedures, again impacted by COVID. There were strong sales with growth there with regards to our custom procedural pack business and gains there in the orthopedic business, which will also provide further growth opportunity. Within capital consumables, there was a slight decline in ROIC compared to the half one. Looking now at service and technology, revenue there of 95.6 million, an underlying EBITDA of 12.2 million, and a ROIC of 8%. There's been really strong and good progress regarding the integration of Quantum and Paragon services here within the service and technology pillar. And there has been a move to the one ERP platform, which will accelerate this further moving forward. Really strong performance in Paragon Asia with regards to Thailand and Korea, and their performance outperformed. And there has been, within ANZ, slower than expected growth of new agencies technology. If you were to add up all that underlying EBITDA, you'll find that we've got corporate costs that would offset that of about 5.3 mil, which then takes us back to our reported underlying EBITDA of a 38.4. Just stepping through to the next slide and just focusing on cash flow. Our cash flow position, as Mark said, with regards to when we look at our net debt position, which cash is a factor of, that has gone up by 13.7. And the key movement in that is really in regard to that investing activities with the acquisition there of SMS. Operating activities were more or less, that cash flow from operating activities was more or less in line with the prior comparative period. Inventory, at the back there is a balance sheet in this slide deck, the inventory is increased by 12 mil. One of that is attributable to SMS. There's about 6 mil there in Paragon Asia and an increase there, the remainder within ANZ. All aligned though with growth in sales. Trade receivables increased by 6 mil, again aligning with revenue growth, and that increase includes receivables of 1.4 mil at June for SMS. Trade and other payables, 12 mil, and this increase really does reflect the impact of acquisitions and aligned with the increase there in inventories and some slight timing differences over the year. Just in summary, in terms of that net investing and finance movement, mainly due to we did pay dividends throughout FY28 of in total around 8 mil. Ongoing CapEx there predominantly within Mount Waverley and the SMS acquisition. The last slide that I'll step through in detail is our capital management slide. Mark's already spoken to the fact that we will be paying a final dividend of 0.6 cents per share fully franked, which does represent a 43% payout ratio, which is at the lower end of the payout ratios we have. We normally between 40 and 60, so that this is at the low end. We have franking credits of 22.4 mil as at the 30th of June. Just stepping through some of those key dates with regard to the dividend, we've got the DIP election date on Monday the 18th, ex-dividend date Monday the 18th of September, record date Tuesday the 19th of September, and the payment date is Friday the 6th of October. With regards to banking arrangements, we did in December, for the half year there in December when we spoke in February about finalising the NAB and HSBC banking facilities, which we have for about 4 years. And just to mention, we do have an interest rate swap there. It's for 4 years. It's for $35 million. And the base rate there is at 3.5. There is more details in the financial statements. So thank you for letting me indulge there. I will now pass it back to Mark.
Thanks, Josie. Last part of the presentation is just a further update on our strategy and, I guess, more importantly, where we are from an execution viewpoint. So let's start with the famous light on the hill. It is a really important reference point for the business and genuinely acts as a guide for all of our long-term thinking, but also all of our short-term actions. You'll also notice in the slide, I've actually changed the timeline. We originally referred to this as 3 to 5 years for this ambition. I've now changed that to FY 2027. It's quite a deliberate change. I just don't want our activity here slipping out, you know, each year and the 3 to 5 years moving out. So we've deliberately put a deadline on it to say, well, FY 2027 is when we're targeting to deliver this. On the next slide, we've done some further work to try and better describe what we do and where some of the medium-term growth drivers are. As part of this, we're now showing the diagnostics pillar as having a manufacturing and distribution focus. And while I know we've talked about that previously, I just wanted to make that a bit clearer. Whereas the activity for the rest of the pillars is mainly focused on distribution slash agency type arrangements. All of these pillars have various growth options in front of them. And as I said previously, it's not about being able to deliver every last one of them. But there is a process to go through to make sure we're focusing on the right ones to leverage what I think is a very unique footprint that the Paragon Care Group has. And as I said previously, the aim here is to deliver at half of the journey to the 100 million via organic growth. So, you know, as I commented in my opening statement, I think I'm more confident about the measures we've got in place to deliver that than 12 months ago, which is a natural consequence of having gone through that strategic planning process. So I'll talk about this a little more as we go through the next few slides. So let's start with the manufacturing part of the business. It sits within the diagnostics pillar. So some of you would know this is the Immulab business that we purchased off CSL about 5 or 6 years ago. While the main business within Immulab is blood reagents, it also manufactures a range of other medical media, all of which is used in the in vitro diagnostics or IVD market. Now, for those of us less educated punters, and I include myself in that bracket, IV generally refers to diagnostic testing on biological samples. So that's the way to think about it. As you can see from this slide, there's a significant growth opportunity over the next 5 to 10 years. And importantly for Immulab, quality is a critical factor in product selection, which is also where in many areas we have process IP. So this is a real jewel in the crown, this one, and we see some quite significant upside for it. Those opportunities fall across three main categories. The first is finished products into end market. So this is taking end product that Immulab already manufactures and pushing that into overseas markets. We used to talk about this as being an opportunity limited to just China. There are certainly geopolitical challenges and have something that's focused entirely on China, but we think the opportunity is much broader than that. And while we'll initially focus on Asia, the work we've done, I think, shows us that there's potential opportunities in Europe and the US as well. The second opportunity is contract manufacturing on behalf of existing manufacturers in this space who are mainly using automated blood testing. And that's the side of the market that, so the Immulab product is used for manual blood testing, so we're not cannibalising the export opportunity by providing this product. It's effectively a private label opportunity if you want to think about it that way. Again, in the initial focus, that'll be a push into Asia, but it has potential in other markets as well. Last but not least is the opportunity to manufacture media or medical fluids. There are a number of significant opportunities here, including the IVF market, so we're exploring those at the moment. So we've talked about this opportunity for quite a while now. So, you know, one of the things I've been really keen to try and get the business to do is to sort of think more critically about the execution piece. So this next slide is focused on some critical timelines that we've identified internally, and we did share this with the market when we did the Investor Day a month or two ago. And it highlights the key milestones against each of the initiatives I've just talked about. So the work to determine key markets and initial entry strategies for finished product we expect to be complete by the end of this year. So this is a mapping of how difficult it is from a regulatory perspective to get into a market versus the size of the commercial opportunity, and then ranking which markets we effectively target earliest. It's, you know, I've said previously, there's no point if it's a fabulous commercial opportunity. It's going to take us 10 years to get the products registered, so let's find the sweet spot in terms of the end market that we can target. What we would hope is that we would be starting to enter key markets in the second half of next calendar year. The only caveat I'd put on that is sometimes there is some regulatory requirements that might take a bit longer, so that would be our expectation at the moment, subject to that caveat around the regulatory piece. The OEM or contract manufacturing business is already making good progress, and I'd expect that we'll have initial contracts in place by December this year, and then we would start to grow this business from that point on. We do think there's some great opportunities there. And last but not least is the raw material and media opportunity I talked about. That's probably the one that's at the earliest stage. You'll see later when I talk about the timeline for some of these opportunities to come in. I think that's probably more a 25 and 26 type opportunity. But, you know, given the scale that's there in markets like IVF and others, we think that one's got a lot of upside for us. A key part of that whole Immulab strategy is the manufacturing footprint we're now building at the Mount Waverley site in Victoria. It's a state-of-the-art facility that significantly increases our manufacturing capability. We were in effect forced to shift this manufacturing complex because CSL was shutting their site in Parkville, but we've used the opportunity to significantly lift the manufacturing capability we've now got because of the opportunities I've just described. Also allows us to consolidate all of our Victorian operations on the one site, which I think culturally and commercially will be an advantage as well. The project's on schedule. We're targeting TGA approvals by sort of end of first quarter next year, and we'll hopefully be in production shortly thereafter. But we've got contingency plans, so, you know, if it takes a little longer to get the TGA approvals, we can still manage that handover. But ideally, we'd like to be in there by the first quarter of next year, and at this stage, that should be the case. Physical completion will actually be done by around October, November this year. So we've just got to go through this process of the regulatory approvals that are going to take another few months. And we're already working with the TGA to make sure we streamline that as much as we possibly can. I guess as we've got closer to the end of the project, we've gone back and done a re-estimate of what it's going to cost to complete. It's likely that the total cost of this are probably going to be around 5 to 10% higher than what we originally thought. We had talked to the market being around 30 mil, so it's probably going to be around that 5 to 10% higher. It simply reflects the fact that as we've got to the end of the project, we've started to cost out some of the service requirements. That's been slightly more expensive than what we thought. So we wouldn't expect that to materially shift from there, but there are some extra costs. I think when we came out and talked to the market when we did our half-year results, we had talked about Centuria providing some additional lease incentive funding to support the completion of this project. So we've been in discussions with Centuria over the last 6 months. We were originally looking to get them to provide an additional 11 to 12 million via an extension to that lease incentive. But whilst they were pretty keen to support us on this one, there was, I think, just changing market conditions in terms of raising funds made that a bit difficult for them. So we're now going to fund that additional spend from our own banking facilities, which we had allowed for when we set up our banking facilities, just in case we couldn't get the Centuria funding. But it means that'll convert into on-balance sheet debt rather than as part of a lease incentive arrangement. Moving now to the distribution or agency part of the business, what Paragon Care can offer, I think, is a really unique solution for original equipment manufacturers, which is what the OEM one is. We have an Asia-Pac footprint. There are lots of challenges for manufacturers who might want to come into this market. I mean, we already represent over 100 manufacturers in these markets who, for a raft of reasons, recognise this is a better solution than coming into the market directly. Some of it's cultural, some of it's scale. So the extra benefit that I think we offer is that we're a one-stop shop in terms of sales, marketing, logistics. And I include in that consumables. So this is providing consumables for the equipment we sell, and the critical component of service and support. The last bit of that in particular, I think, is the more difficult one for OEMs to directly replicate from scratch, which just emphasises the point I've made in previous presentations about the importance of the service and support function, both as a standalone earnings opportunity, particularly in the context of the Paragon Care business, because I think there's uplift that we can chase there, but also as an important retention tool for the existing OEM arrangements that we have in place. So a really comprehensive solution there. And if you look at it in the context of the next slide, I think everyone wins under this model, right? So suppliers, our end customers, because they get a single point solution as well. If you look at it from a Paragon perspective, it builds quite a comprehensive portfolio of defensive revenue at attractive margins. And when you look at the individual components of that, because we've had a few questions about whether there's any particular concentration of risk. So when we did the, when we went through our budget process, you actually got, we got all of the businesses to detail their key customer and supplier contracts. And what we saw was there was no revenue either from an existing OEM arrangement or an end customer arrangement that made up more than 10% of our revenue. I think there was only one that was above 5%. And in terms of reliance, in terms of EBITDA, there's no arranged commercial arrangement in the group that represents more than 5% of EBITDA. So you've got quite a diversified portfolio of risk. So I think that adds to what already is a strong income stream from a defensive point of view. So this next slide is trying to piece together all of what I've just talked to you about. Again, one of the other pieces of feedback we got from investors was people were just looking for a bit more granularity about how the strategies and activities that we've talked about translate in our journey to the targeted ambition of 100 mil of EBITDA. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say I can give you a sort of step-by-step guide as to how you can all add it up to 100 million, but it is, I think, a better description by pillar of the activities that we're undertaking to at least deliver the organic part of the journey to 100 mil, which, as I've said previously, I think will make up at least half of the journey. If it really goes well, it might make up more, but I think, you know, we'd at least expect it to make up half of that journey in the period out to FY27. We've already talked in a bit of detail around the opportunities in diagnostic and scientific, and you can see the timelines I've given you there so that the contract manufacturing opportunity starts to kick in the second half of 24. The export opportunity starts to contribute in FY25, but the media probably doesn't start to contribute until FY26. Devices has a number of drivers for accelerated growth, including whatever measures are ultimately put in place to address the backlog on elective surgery. And there's been plenty of press in the last 6 months about the fact that, despite the fact that volumes have returned closer to pre-COVID levels, there's not been any material activity to address the backlog of elective surgery, so that upside still remains. I've talked previously about some of the challenges we've had in the pain portfolio that was significantly affected by the prosthesis list price reform. So we've got a strategy that we're in the latter stages of implementing to try and rebuild that pain portfolio. And there's also a number of market segments in orthopedics and ophthalmics that we've identified, which will also provide additional drivers for growth. Capital and consumables is not one that we've talked a lot about in terms of the growth prospects going forward. And I think this is one of the pillars that benefited most from going through this strategic planning exercise. They, I think, really did a great job in terms of going back and thinking, okay, if I really wanted to sort of significantly increase the size of this business, what would I do? So they've identified four key initiatives, two of which are in Australia and two of which are in New Zealand. And I've said there it's commercial in confidence, so we'll look to give you more detail over time as these things develop further. But these four key initiatives provide significant uplift to earnings over the next few years if we're successful. The arrangements for two of them are already finalised and in place, and there's another two that we're currently finalising, and I'd expect would be finalised in early calendar 24 and start to contribute in FY25. So you'll see in the chart I've shown most of the contribution from those kicking in FY25, but just to give you comfort that arrangements supporting those for two of them are in place and are in the latter stages of sorting out the other two. In terms of service and tech, there's a combination there of further growth in Asia, which we've talked to you about previously, and also the recovery in the ANZ service and tech business. So this is mainly the old Paragon part of that, the Quantum part of that still runs quite okay. So there is, John's talked to the market when we did the Investor Day about him expecting organic growth in Asia of 10 to 15%. I think we can get at least that out of the ANZ businesses if we get that right. So there's very strong organic drivers across those businesses. And then for completeness, I've shown the M&A piece on the bottom, because I guess that's the complete package in terms of what we're looking to do on this journey to 100 mil. When you look at the previous slide as an overall visual, you can see that While there's some organic growth in FY 2024, the more significant growth occurs in FY 2025 and beyond. We will actually provide some additional commentary about how that's progressing for FY 2024 when we do the AGM in November. Importantly, the targeted ambition of 100 million of EBITDA by FY 2027 is underpinned by the strategies that we've developed over the last 12 months. We've made sure that's been reflected in the budgets that the team's done for FY 2024. There's regular monitoring of that that's happening inside of the business, so we feel, you know, without being overconfident, we feel confident we've got the building blocks in place to deliver on the ambition we've talked about. If we get the execution right, and we continue to build a growing and diversified earnings base in the defensive sector with strong underlying demand, we should be in great shape as we progress over the next few years. That's it for the formal part of the presentation, so happy to take any questions that people might have.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star one one on your telephone. Once again, that's star one one to ask a question.
If you'll all form an orderly queue, everyone will get a go.
Okay, now I'm not showing any questions. Oh, I apologize. We do have a question. One moment, please. We have a question from the line of David Fraser with MST Access. David, please go ahead.
Morning, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Just a quick one and just a clarification. When you're talking about the Mount Waverley facility, you're talking about 5%-10% up on the 30 million that you originally—
Yes.
—forecast. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, that's cool. And second one, just clarifying, obviously, I think the sheet on page 19 is great, but when you're talking about 2024 being organic and then 2025 obviously reflecting what you put on sheet 19, can we take that 2024 being organic is unlikely to be any acquisitions in the next 12 months, or is—
No, 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 it's not meant—
—when they come along?
I mean, if you look at the chart on page 19, I've included M&A, ongoing assessment of M&A from 2024 on, right? I guess the main point I was trying to make was there's some organic, there's some continued organic. And just to make the point again, there was 10% underlying organic growth if you look at it on a like-for-like basis in the group this year. And I know that's not been Paragon's long suit necessarily, and we do expect some organic growth next year. But I guess in terms of the organic initiatives, you get a stronger kick in 2025 and 2026 than you do in 2024. The M&A piece, I think, you know, we're prepared to continue to look at M&A, and where it makes sense, we'll take it on. If that happens in 2024, fine. If it doesn't, then we think we've still got a good, good growth path just from the organic piece.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star one one on your telephone. I'm showing no further questions. With that, I'll hand the call back over to Group CEO and Managing Director, Mark Hooper, for any closing remarks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Look forward to catching up with a few of you over the next few days. Thanks.